KKW, Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
You're listening to Shai Onana, your source for music, mint, and tea. Wednesdays from 2 to 3 on WPFW 89.3 or online at WPFW.org.
غيرنا روض قصير لا يتحكم بالمصير نحنا من
نسير. Good afternoon, everybody. This is Shai Onana with your host Zain Al-Amin. We have a great show today with two guests. Later I will have Rebecca Gordon, author of Mainstreaming Torture. And for now we're going to be talking to Marwan Ahmed, who is a coordinator with Arab Fest, which is happening this Saturday, September 27th. It'll be the first annual Arab Fest, and it's shaping up to be quite an exciting event. Marwan, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
How are you?
I'm doing great, and thank you for having me on your show.
My pleasure. Marwan, tell us how the concept came about for the Arab Fest.
Sure. Well, I moved to this area about a couple of years ago, and I came from the West Coast, where there is an annual Arab festival that takes place where tens of thousands of people gather, whether from the Arab American community or their friends and neighbors. So me and some of my friends decided to put an Arabic festival for the Washington, greater Washington area, and we've been working on it for the last few months.
Excellent. I just happened, my other guest, Marwan, Rebecca, hails from the West Coast.
Marwan.
Okay. Hello. Hi.
Have you been to that?
I have not. Where on the West Coast is the Arab Fest held?
I've been to the one in Southern California, which is Anaheim, Orange County area.
Right.
And there is another one, I believe, in Phoenix, Arizona.
Uh-huh. I live in San Francisco. I don't think we have ours yet, but we will soon.
Hopefully, yes.
Marwan, so what will this festival entail? What's the program like for that day?
Right. Before I tell you the program, let me tell you the goal of the festival.
Of course,
then
yeah,
I'll,
please.
You know, go into the program itself.
Sure, sure.
One of the reasons, there are many reasons why we're doing this festival, but one of the reasons is to connect between the Arab community locally.
Right.
To come together and celebrate their culture in one full day of festivities, full of food, dance, music, games, and rides for the kids. But also, it is very important to us that we open our doors to non-Arabic speaking or Arab culture, you know, and communities to come and enjoy this day with us. We want everybody to join us, whether they're Asian, Hispanic, Blacks, Whites, any background who would like to come and have a joyful day of Arabic culture with us, they're welcome to join us. Now, in terms of the program, we have a number of activities. We have kids' rides and games, as well as a lot of good foods and kebabs and hummus and baba ghanoush, in addition to many... yes. In addition to many arts and crafts vendors, and to top it all, we have excellent and full program on stage for at least 9 hours throughout the day, including dance, music, live performances, and a lot of exciting things happening.
As you talked, before we go into more detail into the program, Marwan, you just remind me. There's something I've been curious about. I've been here in this area since, like, in the DMV area. I've lived in Virginia, lived in Maryland, and now live in D.C. But I've never been able to get my head around where, like, the pockets of the Arab community here. In other areas, when I go to other states, it's very clear to me, but here it seems to be scattered. What has been your experience in doing outreach? Where are those communities?
That's a very good question. The answer to that is difficult, but from my observation, and because I do publish an Arabic newspaper in the area, that Falls Church has probably the most condensed concentration of Arab American, but also there are pockets in D.C. And in Fairfax County, as well as in Maryland, but they're not as close in proximity together and visible as much as in Falls Church. When you drive on the Route 7 and you see number of shops and restaurants and signs in Arabic language and mosque and some churches, those are more visible.
In terms of the the stores, the shops, these shops that have been sponsoring, where are those stores? Where are those? For example, I ask because I frequent places like the Mediterranean Bakery that is in Alexandria, and I've been frequenting it since it was actually a hole-in-the-wall bakery making pita bread. Now it's like a whole supermarket. Are there other places that you've discovered in doing outreach, and especially through your newspaper, which I would like to talk to you about too?
Absolutely. Well, I discovered that Vienna has a decent concentration of Arabic stores on Maple Avenue. Just a stretch of a couple of miles, there are four or five of them between restaurants, groceries, and which carry also a lot of arts and crafts as well. That is probably the hidden jewel of Arab American concentration that is growing in Vienna and Fairfax County.
So back to the program. I've been keeping track of new of the announcements that are coming up, and there's several artists that have been announced. Can you talk a little bit about these? Who are these artists? What kind of entertainment would people expect at the Arab Fest?
Absolutely. We have a lot of exciting things happening, and it took us some hard work and number of months to put it together. It varies from Sudanese children dance and music and singing group. There are 24 children who will be on the stage performing. We have an Egyptian dervish skirt or whirling dervish performance.
Fantastic.
That guy who wears the nice colorful skirt and keeps turning. It's a dervish dance. He's coming from New York. We have singers from Morocco, Yemen, Iraq, Lebanon, Palestine, and other performances also from Egypt. So it's a nice variety of different entertainment will be on the stage all day.
Fantastic. For those of you who are tuning in, this is Shainana with your host Zain Amin. My guest is Marwan Ahmed, a coordinator with Arab Fest, which will be the first annual Arab Fest that we have in the DMV area. It'll contain all kinds of musical acts, all kinds of foods. It should be a spectacular event. It will be at Bull Run Regional Park in Centerville, Virginia. What are the times for that? And what is the website for that, Marwan, or any links you might have?
Right. Our website is www.arabfest.org. And we have links from there to our social media, which is Facebook and Twitter. As far as the timing of the event, it will open 10 a.m. and until 10 p.m. on Saturday, September 27th. There are tickets available online to our website, discounted tickets, and there are tickets at the door as well for adults and children. Children under 7 will be, can enter the festival for free. And one more thing, we are offering people who buy their tickets online a chance to enter a drawing for a round-trip international ticket on Turkish Airline anywhere in the world if they buy their ticket online between now and tomorrow midnight.
Excellent. And between now and tomorrow midnight is actually also the last chance to get discounted tickets, right, Marwan?
Absolutely. After tomorrow midnight, the tickets will go higher online and at the door.
Marwan, I wanted to talk. Can you tell us a bit about the newspaper that you put out?
Sure. Well, I come from a publishing background when I was living in Arizona, and I published two newspapers there for the last 20 years, and I still publish them right now too. And when I came to the area, I noticed that there is no Arab-American publication that link the community together and allow non-Arab speaking to understand and learn about Arab people and culture. So I decided to publish the Arab-American Voice newspaper, which is bilingual, Arabic and English. And it's been out in the market for the last 6 months.
And it is the Arab-American
Voice.
And yeah. It's available online and in hard copy?
Yes, it is available digitally online
on
a website and in hard copy. And it's distributed throughout the DMV region.
And what kind of issues and what kind of articles would one find in the Arab American Voice?
Well, unlike many other ethnic publications, including Arabic around the country, my goal is to concentrate on local issues. I know Arabs like to follow international news because of all the things happening back in their home countries. But I also feel and believe that there are many important issues for us to address locally. So my newspaper focuses 80 to 85% on local news and activities of Arab Americans, whether it's politics, economics, social, cultural, and a little bit, if needed, touching the international issues from an analytical point of view.
Excellent. If you're just tuning in, this is Shine Nana with their host, Zain Lamin. My guest is Marwan Ahmed, who is a coordinator with the upcoming Fantastic Arab Fest. It will be the first regional event of its kind. This will be going on at Bull Run Regional Park in Centerville, Virginia, and it will be happening this Saturday, September 27th. It'll start at 10 a.m. and it'll end at 10 p.m. And there will be all kinds of musical acts from all over the Arab world. There will be a performance by dozens of children. There will be whirling dervishes that will be performing, that are coming down from New York. There will be all the kinds of foods that you love and crave from all over the Middle East. And this will be the last, the next 24 hours will be the last opportunity for people to buy discounted tickets. And the website to go to get information is www.arabfest.org. That's www.arabfest.org. Thank you very much, Marwan.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for the opportunity.
Our pleasure.
And hopefully we can see you and everybody at the festival.
I'll definitely be there.
Excellent. Thank
Take
you.
Care.
Bye-bye.
وعكت اللي انك ما حبيت او انك هالفترة بس تسليت انا بدي اعرف انت ليه فليت لشو ما بعلمي امبارح كنا احلى اتنين وعم بتخطط من هلأ لسنتين وتقلي رح نبقى سوا بعدين مخنوق أسئلتي عم تكتر وما عمروق اللي دخلك ليش دايما ظهرك مبروق مبروق لازم تجاوب حد تعرف ليش جيت أحبك إمتى نسيت تعرف ليش جيت أضمك إمتى سهيت أنا كل اللي عملته إني غنيت
Good afternoon, everybody. If you're just tuning in, this is Shai and Nana with your host Zain Al-Amin. We just had Marwan Ahmed to talk about the Arab Fest, and now we have a guest who's tracked across many states to be here with us, Rebecca Gordon, author and activist. Rebecca is the author of Mainstreaming Torture, which came out. It came out last May, right?
Right.
Just came out last May on Oxford University Press, and it focuses on torture in post 9/11 America. And are you still working with are you a member of War Times?
I am still working with War Times Tiempo de Guerras, which is an online organization that works to bring a race, class, and gender lens to issues of war and peace around the world. We started as a bilingual Spanish and English paper in the months immediately following the attacks of September 11th, when we wanted to tell people in this country that there is an alternative to a military response to those attacks. And over the years, the paper portion has ceased to publish as the internet has become a more common way for people to get their information. And so now we are at www.war-times.org, and you will find us there.
Is it mainly based in New York or all over War Times?
Our writers are all over the United States, but most of the people who work on it are in the Bay Area, in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I used to have the impression that it was mainly New York, but it says
that's because our editor Bob Wing for a while was in New York when he was helping to work with United for Peace and Justice. But no, we're West Coast based.
I was influenced by the fact that Francesca Florentini was working there, a friend of mine, and she was operating from New York.
And then she was operating from Argentina.
Right,
and she is now living in San Francisco and working for Al Jazeera Plus,
which
is their new, Al Jazeera's new YouTube and online channel. And you should check out Francesca because she's doing some very interesting things.
Yes, and in a very whimsical and entertaining way. Al Jazeera Plus is doing some great work. I'm using I've mentioned this before, but I'm using their little clips in class to educate them on current events.
That's great.
Yeah. So, Rebecca, you've been trekking around the country, and talking about torture, streamlining torture, which is the mainstreaming torture, which is the book that you've authored in May, can you talk a bit about why did you decide to focus on torture?
That's a really good question. In fact, I was just in Springfield, Illinois, and somebody asked me the question, the United States war in Iraq has caused so many deaths that compared to the number of people who've been tortured, the number of deaths is just so much greater. So why are you even bothering to focus on this issue?
Right.
And I think that I have both personal and political reasons. The personal reasons have to do with my own life experience, because in the 1980s, I spent time in Central America, in Nicaragua, and then later a little bit in El Salvador. And my job there was to travel to towns where the Contra, the counter-revolutionary force the U.S. was supporting and training, had attacked people, and to take the testimonies from those who had survived. And it was very clear that it was an intentional military strategy of the Contra to use terror and specifically torture to frighten the ordinary civilian population of Nicaragua. And I met people who had been tortured. I met people who had been captured by the Contra, taken to Honduras, tortured, and then put back into, forcibly recruited into the Contra and sent back into Nicaragua to do to other people what was done to them, which is the way that torturers are made in general, usually voluntarily, but through a process of brutalization like that. And then when I worked in El Salvador, I was on a two-week delegation there, and one of the main liaisons between my delegation and the trade union movement in El Salvador was picked up and taken to prison and tortured. And we were able to visit him a few days later, and he described to us what had been done to him, again, by a government that was aided and trained and instructed by my own country. So when the attacks of September 11th happened, it is amazing how quickly it became clear that whatever else the U.S. response was going to be, it was going to include torture. And a lot of people don't know this. You probably do, that within just a few days of those attacks, somewhere close to 600 Muslims living in the United States, some of them with green cards, some of them with other sorts of visas, some I believe were U.S. citizens, were rounded up by the FBI. Many of them were taken to a jail in Brooklyn, where they were held incommunicado without access to attorneys or even to their families, some for as long as 6 months, and during that time they were tortured. Not one of those people ever had any kind of connection, not only to September 11th, but to any kind of terrorism whatsoever. None of them were ever charged with anything to do with terrorism. A few were deported because they had outstayed their visas, which is the way most people get to the U.S. illegally. And the kinds of things that were done to them were things that would become familiar to us. They were exposed to terrible loud noise that never stopped. They were beaten. They were short shackled. They were shackled and made to stand in stress positions. They were exposed to extreme cold. At least one of them was raped anally with a police flashlight. All of this, as the New York Times said, within sight of the Statue of Liberty, so on Liberty Isle. So this was already happening. And the thing is, you didn't have to read some kind of left-wing newspaper to know that. It was right there in the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Right.
And in the same way, I began to see in the ordinary mainstream press, people who would never have said anything about torture starting to talk about it. So as early as November 5th, November 5th Newsweek published an editorial by a guy named Jonathan Alter, who is an historian and a journalist and is well known for his biography of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and other things. And in fact, when I was giving this talk at a retirement home recently, one of the people raised her hand and said, "Wait a minute, you don't mean little Johnny Alter?"
Right.
He used to play in my backyard. How right, shame right. on him. But what he wrote was, in this autumn of our anger, even right. a liberal like me finds his thoughts turning to torture. And he went on and said that he wanted to torture or see tortured the people the FBI had picked up in order to what he called jumpstart the investigation of the greatest crime in American history. Now, right. some of us might think the greatest crime in American history was, the enslavement of millions of Africans. But from his point of view, this was the greatest crime that had ever been committed.
Wow.
And, of course, it was a terrible crime. But and it's interesting, too, that he wasn't using the excuse that would be used later to justify torture, which was to protect us from a future possible attack. It was to jumpstart the investigation into something that had already happened. In other words, torture as a form of law investigation.
Right, yeah. So we've gone through this period, past 9/11, and we got to a point where this was being presented or normalized more and more, and that's really the issue you're trying to address.
That's right? It exactly. That's why the title of the book is Mainstreaming, because in fact, before September 11th, it's fair to say, I think, that there was a kind of a settled consensus, an agreement in this country that whatever the United States government might be doing in secret in terms of training other regimes, and so that includes Latin America, Greece, the Philippines, wherever we were training people in so-called interrogation, that in fact torture was wrong and that it was something that we, with our American values, did not do. Right. And after September 11th, there was this shift, both in the mainstream media and then also if you read academic ethicists who were writing about the issue, you saw the same kind of shift. And what I discovered was that everyone who was talking about torture was making what I think is the same really fundamental mistake, because they were treating it as if it were an episode, an action that you take suddenly in a moment of terror, like Jack Bauer saving Los Angeles from a terrorist by torturing the one person who absolutely for sure knows how to stop the bomb. And that's not what torture is. Right. If you look historically at many regimes that have practiced torture, and what I'm talking about here is an institution. I'm talking about institutionalized state torture.
Right.
What you discover is that it's an ongoing practice. Right. It has an infrastructure. It has a physical built infrastructure, and it also has an intellectual and a moral infrastructure. It has a history. It has traditions. It has rituals of initiation, ways that people are brought into the practice. And I'm going to argue that it also has certain kinds of values, certain ideas about what courage is, what about justice is, moderation, and my favorite virtue of all, practical wisdom. And I think that it deforms those moral habits, not only in the people who practice torture, but in a nominally democratic society like the United States.
Right.
I think to the extent we know it's going on and we allow it as the price of our security, that torture deforms us too.
Right.
And
right.
So my working title for the book was actually A Nation of Cowards.
Right.
But the publisher thought that was over the top.
Right, yeah.
But I think it's really true that when we make a deal with the government, and the deal that we are offered is this, we promise, we the U.S. government, promise you that you will always be secure if you just allow us to do a few little things over here. Torture the really bad people who we know are really bad because we have infinite wisdom and we can identify the really bad people absolutely. And also, by the way, listen in on your phone calls and your email and collect all kinds of metadata from you. But in return for this, we guarantee security.
Right. Yeah.
Of course, the reality is it's a lie.
Right.
There is no guarantee of security.
Right.
The government cannot promise us security, but what it can do is make us afraid.
Right, yeah.
And when you're afraid and you say, I will permit anything to happen in order to keep me safe, we have a word for that. It's cowardice.
Right. The whole issue of security is at the heart of the thing. And how they've defined security, how they've redefined security over the years is a huge thing. In my global literature, I teach global literature and social change at the University of Maryland, and there's always a surprise film, and everybody thinks it's some dark, profound film. But what I show is the animated, Pixar or whatever it is, film Monsters Inc. and it's to demonstrate how the whole concept that you just described is that what is the storyline of Monsters Inc. It's these monsters that go to 9 to 5 to their job. They are told to enter through these kind of magical doors and scare children on the other side, scare humans in this other dimension. And when the kids Have you ever seen the film?
I have not seen
it,
no.
When the kids scream, now you have to see it.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
Because you have to use it.
You're right.
And when the kids scream, their screams are bottled and are used by the company that hires them to basically generate power for the whole city.
Oh, my goodness.
So everything, electricity, everything's run based on the screams, on these bottled screams.
Oh, my goodness.
And the coup that happens in the film is that two monsters accidentally take a child home. Now, there's another layer of it, and understand that this movie was made under Bush.
Right.
And there's the other layer is the fact that they are told, like you just said, they are told that these people are toxic. Mm-hmm. You cannot touch them. You cannot interact with them. You can't talk with them. And if you touch them so much as you touch a human child, you will have to be detoxified. Your hair will be removed, etc., etc. Well, and in the end, they discover when they take this child home that they're not toxic. And secondly, when they accidentally make the child laugh, it lights up the whole apartment. They realize that laughter, actually bottled laughter, generates more power than the screams. so we have to talk about the issues of security and stuff coming out of it.
Yeah. This is wonderful because another aspect of torture that is true with every regime is that there is within the society that does the torture a group of people who are identified as legitimate targets for torture.
Right.
Right? Like the children are legitimate targets because they are toxic and dangerous.
Right.
And so, for example, in Chile, under Pinochet, the people who were tortured were referred to as humanoid. As if they were almost but not quite human.
Wow, wow.
And in Greece, they were called bugs or vermin. And in Brazil, they were literally treated as if they were not even human, not even animals, but demonstration equipment. In that, under the CIA, training the Brazilian police during the time when the generals were in charge, they used to go out on the street and pick up homeless people and bring them in front of an audience of police cadets and demonstrate how to torture people on these people whose only crime was that they had happened to be living on the street because they were too poor to live anywhere else. But they were considered not really human because they were street people.
Yeah.
And in a similar way, throughout U.S. history, there are groups of people who have been legitimate targets for torture, and one of those is obviously people of African descent. And it begins with slavery.
Right.
It begins at the moment that enslaved people were first brought to the United States, or it wasn't even the United States yet. There's an excellent history by a man named Edmund Morgan, which is now almost 40 years old, called American Slavery, American Freedom, in which he explains how, given the economics of the situation, people of African descent, so the usual people who were working in the fields to start with were indentured servants from England who had been brought over either because they volunteered and agreed to work for 7 years in order to pay off their passage, or because they had been convicted of minor crimes like vagrancy and scooped up and sent to the colonies. In any case, they knew that if they worked for 7 years or if they ran away and got caught maybe for 10 years, eventually at the end of that period, they would get 50 acres of their own to farm and they would be able to start a new economic life. Mm-hmm. When they brought people from Africa, there was no promise that they were going to get 50 acres. Mm-hmm. There was no promise that they would ever be free, no matter how much they worked. In fact, their children and their grandchildren would also be enslaved. Mm-hmm. And so what they discovered was that in those circumstances, the only incentive that would force people to work was pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so torture, pain, mutilation is right there at the very root of slavery. There could not have been slavery without torture.
Right.
And so at the very beginning, African people, well, they're only 3/5 of a person in the U.S. Constitution, right?
Right.
For purposes of apportionment for Congress. But furthermore, we see this carried through after the end of slavery and the end of Reconstruction. There was another whole wave of the use of African bodies for labor in the leasing of people who had been convicted of very, very minor crimes, like having no, quote, visible means of support.
Right.
And companies, mainly from the northern United States, came down to the southern U.S. and leased people as if they were machinery to work, especially in steel mills and in mines. And many of them were worked to death. And the same kind of torture, the same kind of beatings, whipping, all of that was part of that process.
Mm-hmm.
And then we come forward again to lynching, which is another form of institutionalized state torture, where agents of the state, in this case sometimes in civilian clothing, in a socially embedded way, murdered and tortured to death people of African descent as a form of entertainment and also obviously as a form of social control.
Right.
And again, we see that today in our own jails and prisons, where again we have a population whom it is legitimate to subject to rape. It is legitimate to subject them to the horrible torture of solitary confinement, of never having contact with another human being. In my state, California, there are people who have lived in solitary confinement for as long as 2 decades. And we know that in as short as 2 weeks, that can make a person psychotic.
Uh-huh.
And so, to get back to the Monsters, Inc. story, all of this is predicated on the idea that there are groups of people who are really not quite human, mm-hmm. and who of whom we should be very much afraid.
Right.
And who are therefore legitimate targets for whatever it takes to keep us, whoever we are, safe.
Right, yeah.
And of course, it's a lie, because ultimately what the government is saying to you is, let us do what we want and you will never die. Mm-hmm. It's like a fake promise of immortality.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I hate to break it to you, Zane, but all of us in this room, we are going to die one day.
Right.
And no amount of torture or state security can prevent that.
Right. Yep. If you're just tuning in, this is Shine Nana with your host, Zane Lamine. My guest is Rebecca Gordon, the author of Mainstreaming Torture. And we're talking about changes in terms of policy towards torture. And I wanted to ask you, Rebecca, like in your research on torture in the post 9/11 period, Did you see how do you see the change between the two administrations, the attitude towards torture?
The Bush and Obama. Okay, so this is an important question. I think that there's no question that there was an appetite for torture in the Bush administration.
Right.
That there was a real understanding on the part, especially of Dick Cheney and, to a lesser extent, Donald Rumsfeld, that the purpose of torture is not to collect information.
Right.
The purpose of torture is to take apart those social bodies that might represent some kind of threat or challenge to the regime that's doing the torture. And this is true all over the world, and it's also true in the United States. And I think that, therefore, the Bush administration was perfectly happy to do what they did and to allow a certain amount of it to become public, because torture really only does its job if other people know that it's happening.
Right.
Either so that they're afraid that it will happen to them or to other members of their organization, or they're afraid that their organization has been poisoned by people who have been captured and given up information. But also so that people in the United States can understand just how great the danger is. The logic sort of goes, well, if our government, a good government, a leader, a human rights leader in the free world, is forced to do such terrible things, think how terrible the enemies must be that we face.
Right.
Think what dreadful people they must be, and think what great danger we must be in, because otherwise we would never do that.
Right.
And so we become the audience for this striptease of power, as William Kavanaugh has called it. But when Barack Obama was running for president and when he took office, he was very clear that he was opposed to torture. He was very clear that those things that the CIA called enhanced interrogation techniques were illegal and had to stop. He also promised he was going to shut down Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as he came into office, he issued an executive order that told the CIA they had to shut their black sites, their secret sites where they were doing interrogations all over the world. And he said that they were no longer allowed to use these techniques, the specific ones that had been called enhanced interrogation, including waterboarding. But he still allowed what's called extraordinary rendition, in other words, shipping people out to other countries, supposedly not if they're going to be tortured. But I'm sorry, if you send someone to Morocco or you send someone to Syria, as the U.S. did during the War on Terror, and say, you know, get X, Y, or Z information out of these people, we don't care how, you are asking for those people to be tortured.
Right.
And, right. You know, that happened all over the world. The other thing that he didn't do was close Guantanamo. Guantanamo is still open as you and I are sitting here today. People are still on hunger strike. People are still being tortured with solitary confinement, with indefinite detention when they have no idea if or when they will ever be released. And if they use the one nonviolent means of resistance that they have available, which is the hunger strike, they are then tortured again with force feeding, which is a horrible form of torture, in which there was an op-ed about a year ago in the New York Times called Gitmo is Killing Me. You can Google it if you want, but it's in it the author describes what is being done to him as he is strapped into a chair and has the nasal tube forced down his nose and into his stomach, and he says the pain is worse than anything he's ever experienced. So, and this has gone on under the Obama administration. In addition, we don't really know about any of the other agencies besides the CIA. Obama's executive order only covered the CIA. And in fact, there is, for example, the Joint Special Operations Command, which is a military organization made up of members of some of the elite military parts of each of the services, so Navy SEALs, U.S. Army Rangers, the elites of the Air Force, and so forth. And they had their own torture camp in Baghdad,
right,
which was called Camp Nama. Uh-huh. And their slogan, and it was up on the posters on the wall, was no blood, no foul. In other words, if the person doesn't bleed, then you can do whatever you want to them.
Right, right.
And they also are currently responsible for both training and interrogation and doing interrogation in Africa under U.S. AFRICOM. So right now, for example, they're assisting, supposedly training the Nigerian military in interrogation, as the Nigerian government supposedly in their fight against Boko Haram. So, again, they're in Sudan, they're in Somalia. We don't know what they're doing, and nothing that President Obama has done prevents them from doing whatever it is they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, supposedly the CIA black sites are closed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they are, do you?
Mm-hmm.
And we still haven't been able to see the report that the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is chaired by Dianne Feinstein, who's actually a great friend of the intelligence community, when she gets mad, you know that it's really pretty bad. There's a 6,000-page report that they have had ready to go now for a couple of years on what the CIA did. And we can't get that report released. They were ready to release it, but so much of it was redacted, was just blacked out, that the committee said, no, this isn't good enough. We want the whole thing released. And little bits of it are beginning to leak out now. And it seems that just in terms of the actual physical things that the CIA did to their prisoners, it's much worse than anything that we had heard, including holding people's heads in tubs of ice water to the point where they almost drown and then pulling them up again. And if you've ever seen the Battle of Algiers, you know what I'm talking about. This was the French technique.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, I think one thing that happened when Obama became president was that he discovered what the limits of the power are, even of a president of the United States, and I'm going to say especially of an African-American president of the United States, that there is an entrenched, institutionalized security state that even the president can't control or can't control completely.
Right.
I just want to add that as the United States just yesterday began bombing in Syria in addition to Iraq, and as they're beginning to talk about putting ground troops, U.S. ground troops, back into that part of the world, that we should be very careful as we look at how at the propaganda that comes out, not so much about what ISIS or the Islamic State is doing in the Arab world, but there's propaganda beginning to come out now about jihadis from, quote, the West getting training there and then coming back into this country to do terrorism. And so there's a new round of fear and fear-mongering that's being built up right now under the Obama administration.
Right. If you're just tuning in, this is Shayan Nana with your host Zain Al-Amin. My guest is Rebecca Gordon, author of Mainstreaming Torture. Rebecca, when, in terms of, is there a, do you have a website so that people can get more information about the book or get the book itself? And
I do. I have a website. It's called MainstreamingTorture.org.
Uh-huh.
And there you can find a list of events, places where I'm going to be speaking. You can get in touch with me. You can read some blog posts, some shorter articles that I've written about the issue. And there are some resources for people who want to do something about torture. There are a number of national organizations and also local organizations that are doing really excellent work in this country, focusing not only on torture in the so-called war on terror, but also torture today in U.S. jails and prisons, which, as I said before, is one of the main places where it's happening in plain sight. And it's talk about normalized. It's what you see every night on television. You turn on your television, and at any time, day or night, I swear, you can watch a rerun of Law & Order SVU or something similar, and I can tell you the plot right now.
Right.
A man does a bad thing.
Right.
They pick him up. They know without a shadow of a doubt, without a trial or anything, that he is truly the perp, the bad guy. They throw him in the interrogation room.
Right.
They talk to him. They tell him, you should not ask for a lawyer, which, of course, is his right, because if you do, we're going to have to send you to Rikers, and which is the prison outside of New York City. And I hate to think what would happen to a pretty boy like you in Rikers.
Right.
There's this threat of rape.
Right.
That is a major plot point of many, many police procedurals. You'll also see plot points that say, you know, we're, especially if the perp is not from the United States, there's the threat, we're going to send you to Guantanamo.
Right.
We're going to send you where you'll never get out. We're going to put you in an orange suit.
Right.
And this has become so normal that it's just part of our entertainment.
Right, right, yeah. Yeah, that is so true. The normalizing torture through entertainment, through NCIS, through Homeland, through 24 hours, and so on. It's one of the most sickening aspects of American society today, the fact that Americans are consuming this on daily basis and thinking that their security depends on it. And the futility of the war on terror and torture has really shown, is really evident right now, where this monster, you know, ISIS and nothing, they didn't even put a dent. In fact, we have a greater monster to deal with. It's a monster that even Al-Qaeda doesn't want to deal with because they're too violent. So this shows the futility of these methods that the war on terror employed.
Yeah. Depending on what the purpose of the war on terror is.
Right, yeah.
You know, having a perpetual enemy somewhere can actually be useful to a regime, a government that wants to maintain power in part by keeping people afraid.
Precisely.
You know, one very specific link between U.S. historic torture and what's happening right now is an individual named James Steele, who was an Army Ranger in Vietnam. during the time of the Phoenix program, which was a program of torture and assassination in which upwards of 30,000 Viet Cong were tortured, and they called it pump and dump. They were pumped supposedly for information and then dumped into the South China Sea from helicopters, oftentimes when they were still alive. And James Steele went from there to train police and military in El Salvador in interrogation, and then David Petraeus brought him to Iraq to train the Iraqi special commandos units in so-called interrogation.
Wow.
And
wow.
There are people who have described the training that he gave, which included hanging people upside down and pulling out their fingernails and using electrical devices to torture people, which, by the way, goes all the way back to the French in Vietnam. And then the Americans inherited it from the French. The French took it to Algeria, and it eventually came to the police stations in Paris as well. So mm-hmm. this particular method of winding up a field telephone and torturing someone with that, it has a long, long history. But anyway, it was under the al-Maliki government that these special commandos were operating, and because of the particular complexities of politics in Iraq, most of the people that they were so-called interrogating, in other words, intimidating, were Sunni. And
right.
So part of what happened was it created within the Sunni community a space where ISIS was able to enter, which was perhaps even greater than the space they would have had otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's this direct connection.
Yes.
And I, you know, one of the things I say in the book, I talk about torture having three sort of goods or products, uh-huh. and I call them the production of truth, the production of enemies, and the production of torturers themselves.
Right.
So torture produces enemies. First of all, in the obvious way, that
yeah.
it takes people who might not have been your enemy beforehand,
yeah.
but who were scooped up in Afghanistan or somewhere and then tortured for years and then perhaps released. And if they weren't your enemy before, they certainly are now.
Right, right.
But in addition to that, torture creates enemies in the minds of the society that is doing the torture.
Right.
And one of the ways this works is by degrading people. So that if you think back to the pictures from Abu Ghraib that came out, what we saw were human beings. We saw men wearing women's underwear on their heads. We saw men being stacked up naked like cordwood in pyramids. We saw a man on a leash with a collar around his neck being walked as if he were a dog. And all of this, on the one hand, it may invoke pity in somebody, but it also shows you a person who has been so degraded that that person, it also opens up the question, perhaps he deserved it. If somebody was treated this badly, perhaps
right.
this was really
right.
an evil person.
Yeah, and that's the philosophy that's running our prison industrial complex
Absolutely.
Here in the United States.
Absolutely.
If you're just tuning in, this is Cheyenne with your host, Zain al-Amin. Tune in at the top of the hour, 3 o'clock, at for Mind Talk with Pamela Brewer. And my guest has been Rebecca Gordon, author of Mainstreaming Torture. Thank you so much, Rebecca. Thank you for hauling across several states to make it here.
Thank you, Zain. It's been wonderful to be here. I'm so glad I got to do this.
تذكر تذكرني لك يا أخي أوحى تنساني يا حبيبي يا نصيبي كان يودي خليك قربك عارفك عقلي
This is WPFW News. I'm Askia Mohammed. Here are some headlines at the 3 o'clock hour. Metro head Richard Sarles announced today he's leaving the Transit Authority. In a message to Metro employees, he said he will leave in mid-January 2015. Sarles was appointed to the agency's top job in January 2011 after serving for 8 months as the interim general manager. President Barack Obama implored world leaders to unite against a series of international crises, from the rise of militant group Islamic State, which he called a network of death, to the Ebola epidemic in West Africa and Russia's intervention in Ukraine. In his annual address to the United Nations General Assembly today, the president cited, quote, the cancer of violent extremism in the Middle East as the single issue that could derail future global progress. He said 6 years into his presidency that the world is at a crossroads. Meanwhile, the U.S.-led bombing of militant targets inside Syria has intensified as Pentagon officials acknowledge a military mission that could take years. Speaking from the White House, President Obama vowed to take the fight to ISIS.
Once again, it must be clear to anyone who would plot against America and try to do Americans harm that we will not tolerate safe havens for terrorists who threaten our people. The overall effort will take time. There will be challenges ahead, but we're going to do what's necessary to take the fight to this terrorist group for the security of the country and the region and for the entire world.
The D.C. Council approved a bill allowing concealed gun carry in public places yesterday. The concealed carry permits will be restricted to people proving a reason for carrying a weapon. Tamika Smith has more.
The bill passed D.C. Council unanimously, but several of the body's 13 members say they felt pushed to vote for the measure. This after a federal judge struck down the city's longstanding ban on carrying weapons. The new regulations would allow district residents who own registered handguns to apply to D.C. police for a concealed carry permit. If you're not a resident, the same rules would apply. Although you can carry a weapon concealed, they won't allow guns on public transportation, in government buildings, schools, and daycare facilities. Wearing a weapon in a holster in public view isn't in the law. If an applicant is denied, the decision can be appealed and reviewed by a 5-member review board. The board will be appointed by the mayor. For WPFW News, I'm Tamika Smith.
The D.C. Council will consider banning racially based nicknames for public schools in the nation's capital. Democratic Councilmember Kenyon McDuffie introduced a bill Tuesday that would force 7 schools in D.C. to change nicknames referring to American Indians. McDuffie says the council should continue to push the NFL's Washington team to change their name. He and other D.C. leaders say the name is offensive. McDuffie says there's an air of hypocrisy on the city's effort as long as it continues to permit racially based nicknames, logos, and mascots. The bill would create an exemption for schools which establish an agreement with a federally recognized American Indian tribe to use a name. A flood watch has been issued for the District of Columbia, Northern Virginia, Baltimore, and other parts of Maryland. The National Weather Service issued the watch early this morning. It will be in effect this evening through late into the night. Counties under the watch include Montgomery, Prince George's, Anne Arundel, Harford, and Howard. Cloudy and rainy this afternoon. Breezy with rain tonight, low 64. Rain on Thursday, high 71. Currently, it's cloudy and 72 degrees. Gloria Minot will have headlines at 3:55. On Live at 5 today, it's the Billy Thompson Band. Stay tuned now for Mind Talk with Dr. Pamela Brewer. I'm Askia Mohammed. Thank you for listening to WPFW Washington.
This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. Today's conversation may be a little difficult for some of you, so I want to let you know up front that we are going to be talking to a